Chapter 39. Waiting for Daybreak. 3 days after the rainy season ended, a young man named Sudatta paid a visit to the Buddha to ask if he would come teach the Way of Awakening in Kosala. Sudatta was an extremely wealthy merchant. He lived in the capital city, Savatthi, in the kingdom of Kosala, which was ruled by King Pasenadi. Sudatta was known to his country people as a philanthropist who always set aside a generous portion of his income to share with orphans and the destitute. His charitable efforts gave him much satisfaction and happiness. His people called him Anathapindika, which means the one who cares for the poor and abandoned. Sudatta traveled frequently to Mogoda to buy and sell goods. When in Rajagaha, he stayed with his wife's elder brother, who was also a merchant. His brother-in-law always treated him with the greatest affection, assuring that every detail of his stay was pleasant. He was staying with his brother-in-law at the end of the rainy season. Unusually, his brother-in-law did not cater to many of his needs. Instead, he busily directed family members and servants in preparation for some great feast. Sudatta was surprised to arrive and find the household in the midst of so much activity. He asked if they were preparing to hold a wedding or death anniversary observance. The brother-in-law answered, "Tomorrow I have invited the Buddha and his bhikkhus for a meal." Sudatta asked with some surprise, "Doesn't Buddha mean one who is awake?" "That is right. The Buddha is an awakened person. He is an enlightened master. He is wondrous and radiant. Tomorrow you will have a chance to meet this wonderful person." He could not explain why, but just hearing the name Buddha filled Sudatta with happiness and inspiration. He sat his brother-in-law down and asked to hear more about this enlightened teacher. The brother-in-law explained how, after watching the serene bhikkhus beg in the city, he had gone to hear the Buddha at Bamboo Forest Monastery. He had become one of the Buddha's lay disciples and had even built a number of thatched huts at the monastery as an offering in order to protect the bhikkhus from the sun and rain. He had overseen the building of 60 huts in a single day. Perhaps, Sudatta marveled, it was from a past life connection, but he felt great love and respect for the Buddha well within his heart. He could not wait until the following noon to meet the Buddha. He spent a restless night, anxiously waiting for daybreak so that he could pay a morning visit to Bamboo Forest Monastery. 3 times he arose from his bed to see if it was dawn yet, but each time the sky was still dark. Unable to sleep anymore, he got up anyway. He dressed, slipped into his shoes, and walked out the door. The air was cold and misty. He passed through Sivaka Gate and made his way to Bamboo Forest. By the time he arrived, the first rays of morning sunlight were shining on the bamboo leaves. Though he wanted nothing more than to meet the Buddha, he felt somewhat nervous. To calm himself, he whispered, "Sudatta, do not worry." At that very moment, the Buddha, who was doing walking meditation, passed Sudatta. He stopped and said softly, "Sudatta." Sudatta joined his palms and bowed before the Buddha. They walked to the Buddha's hut, and Sudatta asked the Buddha if he had slept well. The Buddha replied he had. Sudatta told the Buddha how restless a night he had spent, so anxious was he to come and meet the Buddha. He asked the Buddha to teach him the way. The Buddha spoke to Sudatta about understanding and love. Sudatta was filled with great happiness. He prostrated before the Buddha and asked to become a lay disciple. The Buddha accepted him. Sudatta also invited the Buddha and all his bhikkhus to come have a meal the following day at the home of his brother-in-law. The Buddha laughed gently. "My bhikkhus and I have already been invited to eat there today. There is no reason we should expect to eat there tomorrow, too." Sudatta said, "Today my brother-in-law will host you. Tomorrow shall be my offering. I regret I do not have a house of my own in Rajagaha. I entreat you to accept my invitation." The Buddha smiled his acceptance. Overjoyed, Sudatta bowed again, and then quickly returned home to assist his brother-in-law with preparations for that day's meal offering. When Sudatta heard more of the Buddha's teaching at his brother-in-law's home, his happiness knew no bounds. He accompanied the Buddha and the bhikkhus to the gate when the teaching was finished, and at once began to prepare for the following day's meal offering. His brother-in-law joined his efforts with enthusiasm and even said, "Sudatta, you are still my guest. Why don't you let me take care of all the preparations?" But Sudatta would not hear of it. He insisted on taking care of all the expenses himself, only agreeing to let the family help ready the home and cook some of the dishes. When Sudatta heard more of the Buddha's teaching the next day, his heart opened like a flower. He knelt down and said, "Lord Buddha, the people of Kosala have not yet had an opportunity to welcome you and your Sangha and to learn the way of awakening. Please consider my invitation for you to come to Kosala and spend a period of time. Please show compassion to the people of Kosala." The Buddha agreed to discuss the idea with his senior disciples. He promised to give Sudatta a response within a few days. A few days later, Sudatta visited Bamboo Forest Monastery and received the happy news that the Buddha had decided to accept his invitation. The Buddha asked him if there would be some suitable place near Savatthi where a large community of bhikkhus could dwell. Sudatta assured him that he would find a place and would provide for all the Sangha's needs while they were there. Sudatta also suggested that the Buddha allow Venerable Sariputta to come to Kosala with him first in order to assist in preparations for the Buddha's arrival. The Buddha asked Sariputta whether or not he would like that, and Sariputta replied he would be happy to go. A week later, Sudatta came to Bamboo Forest, where he met Sariputta. They set off together, crossing the Ganga and traveling to Vesali, where they were met by Ambapali, and they rested the night in her mango grove. Sariputta told her that she could expect the Buddha and a large number of bhikkhus to pass through Vesali on their way to Kosala in another 6 months. Ambapali said she would be most happy to offer them food and a place to sleep. She told Sariputta and Sudatta that she was most honored to receive them as guests. She commended the young merchant on his many charitable works and encouraged him in his efforts to have the Buddha bring the teaching to Kosala. After bidding farewell to Ambapali, they headed northwest along the banks of the Achiravati River. Sudatta had never walked such distances before, having always used a carriage in the past. Everywhere they stopped, he announced to people that the Buddha and his Sangha would be traveling through the land, and he asked the people to welcome him. "The Buddha is an awakened master. Prepare to welcome him and his Sangha with jubilation." Kosala was a large and prosperous kingdom, no less powerful than Magadha. Its southern border was marked by the Ganga, and its northern border brushed the feet of the Himalayas. Sudatta, or Anathapindika, was known to everyone wherever he went. The people trusted what he told them, and they all looked forward to meeting the Buddha and his Sangha. Every morning, when Venerable Sariputta went begging, Sudatta accompanied him to speak to as many people as he could about the Buddha. They reached Savatthi after a month. Sudatta invited Sariputta to his home for a meal and introduced him to his parents and wife. He asked Sariputta to speak about the Dharma, after which his parents and wife asked to take the 3 refuges and 5 precepts. Sudatta's wife was a lovely and graceful woman. Her name was Pimnalakana. They had 4 children, 3 girls and a boy. The daughters were named Subhadra Elder, Subhadra Younger, and Sumagada. Their son, the youngest child, was named Kala. Sariputta begged every morning in the city and slept in the forest by the banks of the river at night. Sudatta lost no time in searching for a place to host the Buddha and the bhikkhus. Chapter 40. Cover the Land in Gold. Of all the places Sudatta visited, none was more beautiful and peaceful than the park that belonged to Prince Jetta. Sudatta felt sure that if he could acquire this park, it would serve as the perfect place from which the Buddha's way of awakening could be spread to all corners of the kingdom. Sudatta went to see Prince Jetta and found him entertaining a palace official. Sudatta respectfully greeted them both and then expressed directly his hope that the prince would sell him the park to provide a practice center for the Buddha. Prince Jetta was only 20 years old. The park had been a gift the previous year from his father, King Pasenadi. The prince looked at the palace official and then at Sudatta and replied, "My royal father gave me the park. I am very attached to it. I would only part with it if you agreed to cover every square inch of it in gold coins." Prince Jetta was speaking in jest. He certainly wasn't prepared for the young merchant to take him seriously. But Sudatta responded, "Agreed. I will meet your price. Tomorrow I will have the gold brought to the park." Prince Jetta was startled. "But I was only joking. I do not want to sell my park. Don't bother bringing the gold." Sudatta answered with resolve, "Honorable prince, you are a member of the royal family. You must carry out the words you have spoken." Sudatta looked at the palace official drinking tea for support. "Is that not so, your excellency?" The official nodded. He turned to the prince and said, "The merchant Anathapindika speaks the truth. If you hadn't actually quoted a price, it would be different, but you cannot withdraw your offer now." Prince Jeta submitted, but he secretly hoped Sudatta would not be able to meet his price. Sudatta bowed and departed. Early the next morning, Sudatta sent great carts of gold coins and had his servants spread it over the entire park. Prince Jeta was astounded when he saw the great mounds of gold. He understood that this had been no ordinary business agreement. He asked himself why anyone would give so much gold for one park. This Buddha and his Sangha must be truly extraordinary for the young merchant to go to such lengths. The prince asked Sudatta to tell him about the Buddha. Sudatta's eyes shone as he spoke about his teacher, the Dharma and the Sangha. He promised that he would bring Venerable Sariputta to meet the prince the following day. Prince Jeta found himself moved by the things Sudatta told him about the Buddha. He looked up to see that Sudatta's men had already spread gold coins over two-thirds of the forest. Just as a fourth cart was arriving, he held out his hand and stopped them. He said to Sudatta, "That is enough gold. Let the remaining land be my gift. I want to contribute to this beautiful project of yours." Sudatta was pleased to hear this. When he brought Sariputta to meet the prince was impressed by the bhikkhu's peaceful bearing. Together they went to visit the park, which Sudatta had decided to call Jetavana, or Jeta Grove, in honor of the prince. Sudatta suggested to Sariputta that he live at Jetavana to help direct the building of the monastery. He said his family could bring food offerings to Sariputta each day. Together, Sudatta, Sariputta, and the prince discussed building huts, a dharma hall, a meditation hall, and bathrooms. Sudatta expressed a wish to build a three-tiered gate at the forest entrance. Sariputta contributed a number of helpful suggestions regarding setting up the monastery, as he was now very experienced in such matters. They selected an especially cool and tranquil spot to build the Buddha's thatched hut. They oversaw the making of pathways and the digging of wells. The city people soon heard how Sudatta had paved the forest in gold in order to purchase it from the prince. They learned that a monastery was being built to welcome the Buddha and his Sangha, who would soon arrive from Magadha. Sariputta began to give Dharma talks at Jetavana, and the number of people who attended grew daily. Though none of the people had yet met the Buddha, they all felt drawn to his teaching. 4 months later, the monastery was nearly completed. Sariputta set off for Rajagaha in order to lead the Buddha and the bhikkhus back to Jetavana. He met them in the streets of Vesali. Several hundred bhikkhus clad in saffron robes were begging in the streets. He learned that the Buddha and the bhikkhus had arrived in Vesali only a few days previously and were dwelling nearby at Great Forest. The Buddha asked about preparations in Savatthi, and Sariputta recounted how well things were going. The Buddha told Sariputta that he had left Kondana and Uruvelakasapa in charge of the community at Bamboo Forest. Of the 500 bhikkhus presently with the Buddha in Vesali, 200 would remain to practice in the vicinity. The remaining 300 would accompany him on the journey to Kosala. The Buddha told Sariputta that Ambapali had invited the entire Sangha for a meal offering the next day. The day after that, they would depart for Savatthi. Ambapali was happy for the chance to offer the Buddha and his bhikkhus a meal in her mango grove. She only regretted that her son Jivaka was unable to attend because of his medical studies. A curious thing happened the day before she was to serve the Buddha and his bhikkhus a meal. On her way home from visiting the Buddha, her carriage was stopped by several princes of the Likavi clan. They were the most powerful and wealthiest lords in Vesali and traveled in handsome, elegant carriages. They asked her where she was going, and she replied she was on her way home to prepare to receive the Buddha and his bhikkhus the following day. The young nobles suggested she forget about the Buddha and invite them instead. The princes said, "Invite us, and we will pay for the meal with 100,000 pieces of gold." They were certain that hosting a monk could not possibly be as amusing or profitable as entertaining them. Ambapali was not interested. She replied, "It is clear you do not know the Buddha, or you would not speak in such a manner. I have already made arrangements to invite the Buddha and his Sangha. Even if you offered me the entire city of Vesali and all the land surrounding it, I would refuse. Now, if you please, let me pass. I have much to do to prepare for tomorrow." Taken aback, the Likkhavi nobles let her pass. Little did Ambapali know that after their encounter with her, they decided to go and see this teacher who was so highly respected by Ambapali. They left their carriages at the entrance to Great Forest and walked in. The Buddha could tell that these young men possessed many seeds of compassion and wisdom. He invited them to be seated, and he told them about his own life and search for the way. He told them about the path to overcome suffering and realize liberation. He knew they belonged to the same warrior caste he had belonged to, and looking at them, he could see himself as a young man. He spoke to them with warm understanding. Their hearts were opened by the Buddha's words. They felt they could see themselves for the first time. They understood that wealth and power were not enough to bring them true happiness. They knew they had found a path for their lives. They all asked to be accepted as lay disciples. They also asked if they could offer the Buddha and his Sangha a meal the next day. The Buddha said, "We have already been invited by Ambapali for tomorrow." The young nobles smiled, remembering their encounter with Ambapali. "Then allow us to offer you a meal on the following day." The Buddha smiled his acceptance. Ambapali invited all her relations and friends to the mango grove the next day. She invited the Likkhavi nobles as well to hear the Buddha offer teaching. The day after, the Buddha and 100 bhikkhus ate in the prince's palace. They were served elegant and refined vegetarian dishes that had been prepared with the utmost skill and care. The princes also offered the bhikkhus jackfruit, mangoes, bananas, and rose apples freshly picked from their own orchards. When the meal was finished, the Buddha spoke about dependent co-arising and the Noble Eightfold Path. He touched everyone's heart with the teaching. 12 young nobles asked to be ordained as bhikkhus. The Buddha happily accepted them. They included Ottada and Sunakata, 2 princes who wielded great influence in the Likkhavi clan. When the meal and teaching were completed, the Likkhavi nobles entreated the Buddha to come dwell in Vesali the following year. They promised to build a monastery in Great Forest where several 100 bhikkhus could dwell. The Buddha accepted their proposal. Ambapali visited the Buddha early the next morning. She expressed her desire to offer the mango grove to the Buddha and his Sangha. The Buddha accepted her gift. Shortly afterward, the Buddha, Sariputta, and 300 bhikkhus headed north for Savatthi. Chapter 41. Has anyone seen my mother? The road to Savatthi was now familiar to Sariputta. Because he and Anathapindika had nourished people's interest in the Buddha and the Sangha, they were greeted warmly wherever they went. At nights, the bhikkhus rested in the cool forests along the banks of the Achiravati River. They traveled in 3 groups. The Buddha and Sariputta led the first group. The second group was headed by Asaji. The third group was under the guidance of Moggallana. The bhikkhus maintained peaceful serenity as they walked. Sometimes local people gathered in the forests or along the riverbanks to listen to the Buddha's teaching. The day they arrived in Savatthi, they were greeted by Sudatta and Prince Jeta, who took them to the new monastery. Seeing how well planned Jetavana was, the Buddha praised Sudatta. Sudatta responded by saying it was all thanks to the ideas and labor of Venerable Sariputta and Prince Jeta. Novice Rahula was now 12 years old. Though he had been assigned to study under Sariputta's guidance, Sariputta had been gone for 6 months, and so Moggallana had taken his place. At Jetavana, Rahula could resume his studies with Sariputta. Prince Jeta and Sudatta arranged a reception immediately after the Buddha's arrival. Prince Jeta had come to deeply admire the Buddha through his contacts with Venerable Sariputta. They invited all the local people to come to hear the Buddha speak on the Dharma. Many came, including Prince Jeta's mother, Queen Malika, and his 16-year-old sister, Princess Vajiri. After hearing about the Buddha for months, everyone was most anxious to see him in person. The Buddha spoke about the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. After hearing the Dharma talk, the queen and princess felt their hearts open. They both wanted to become lay disciples, but did not dare to ask. The queen wanted to first seek the approval of her husband, King Pasenadi. She was sure that in the near future the king would meet the Buddha and share her feelings. Pasenadi's own sister, who was King Bimbisara's wife, had already taken the three refuges with the Buddha 3 years before. Many important religious leaders in Savatthi also attended the Buddha's discourse that day. Most came out of curiosity rather than a desire to learn anything. But several of them felt their hearts suddenly illuminated when they heard the Buddha speak. Others saw in him a worthy opponent who challenged their own beliefs. Everyone agreed that his presence in Savatthi was a significant event in the spiritual life of Kosala. When the reception and Dharma talk were over, Sudatta respectfully knelt before the Buddha and said, "My family and I, together with all our friends and relations, offer Jetavana Monastery to you and your Sangha." The Buddha said, "Sudatta, your merit is great. Thanks to you, the Sangha will be protected from sun and rain, wild animals, snakes, and mosquitoes. This monastery will draw bhikkhus from all four directions, now and in the future. You have supported the Dharma with all your heart. I hope you will continue to devote yourself to practicing the way." The next morning, the Buddha and the bhikkhus went into the city to beg. Sariputta divided the bhikkhus into 12 groups, each numbering 15. The presence of the saffron-robed monks further aroused the people's interest in the new Jetavana monastery. The people admired the calm and quiet manner of the bhikkhus. Once a week, the Buddha gave a Dharma talk at Jetavana. Great numbers of people attended. Thus, it was not long before King Pasenadi was well aware of the impact of the Buddha's presence. He was too busy with political affairs to visit the Buddha himself, but he listened to many members of his court speak about the new monastery and the bhikkhus from Magadha. During a family meal, the king brought up the subject of the Buddha. Queen Malika informed him of Prince Jetta's contributions to the monastery. The king asked the prince to tell him about the Buddha, and the prince recounted all he had seen and heard. The prince said that if the king granted permission, he wished to become a lay disciple of the Buddha. King Pasenadi had a hard time believing that a monk as young as the Buddha could have achieved true enlightenment. According to the prince, the Buddha was 39 years old, the same age as the king. The king speculated that there was no way the Buddha could have attained a higher state than such elderly spiritual teachers as Puruna Kassapa, Makkali Gosala, Niganta Nataputta, and Sanjaya Belatiputta. Although the king would have liked to believe his son, he had his doubts. He decided that when an occasion arose, he would go and meet the Buddha himself. The rainy season was approaching, and the Buddha decided to spend it at Jetavana. Thanks to the experience gained during previous rainy seasons at Bamboo Forest, the Buddha's senior disciples organized the retreat with ease. 60 new bhikkhus joined the community in Savatthi. Sudatta also introduced many friends who became lay disciples and enthusiastically supported the activities of the monastery. One afternoon, the Buddha received a young man whose face was lined with grief and misery. The Buddha learned that the man had recently lost his only son, and for several days had stood in the cemetery crying out loud, my son, where have you gone?" The man was unable to eat, drink, or sleep. The Buddha told him, "In love there is suffering." The man objected, "You are wrong. Love doesn't cause suffering. Love brings only happiness and joy." The bereaved man abruptly left before the Buddha could explain what he had meant. The man wandered aimlessly about until he stopped to chat with a group of men gambling in the street. He told them of his encounter with the Buddha. The men agreed with him that the Buddha was mistaken. "How can love cause suffering? Love brings only happiness and joy. You're right, that monk Gautama was wrong." Before long, news of this story spread throughout Savatthi and became a subject for heated debate. Many spiritual leaders contended that the Buddha was wrong about love. This matter reached the ears of King Pasenadi, and that evening, during the family meal, he said to the queen, "The monk the people call Buddha may not be as great a teacher as the people seem to think he is." The queen asked, "What makes you say that? Has someone said something bad about teacher Gautama?" This morning I heard some palace officials discussing Gautama. They said that according to him, the more you love, the more you suffer. The queen said, "If Gautama said that, it is undoubtedly true." The king retorted impatiently, "You shouldn't speak like that. Examine things for yourself. Don't be like some small child who believes everything the teacher says." The queen said no more. She knew that the king had not yet met the Buddha. The next morning she asked a close friend, the Brahman Nalijanga, to visit the Buddha and ask him whether or not he had said that love was the source of suffering, and if he had, to explain why. She asked her friend to note carefully everything the Buddha said and report back to her. Nalijanga went to see the Buddha and asked him the queen's question. The Buddha responded, "Recently I heard that a woman in Savatthi lost her mother. She was so grief-stricken that she lost her mind and has been wandering the streets asking everyone, 'Have you seen my mother? Have you seen my mother?' I also heard about two young lovers who committed suicide together because the girl's parents were forcing her to marry someone else. These two stories alone demonstrate that love can cause suffering." Nalijanga repeated the Buddha's words to Queen Malika. One day, soon after that, she caught the king in a moment of leisure, and she asked him, "My husband, do you not love and cherish Princess Vajiri?" "Indeed I do," answered the king, surprised by the question. "If some misfortune befell her, would you suffer?" The king was startled. Suddenly he saw clearly that the seeds of suffering existed within love. His sense of well-being was replaced with worry. The Buddha's words contained a cruel truth which greatly disturbed the king. He said, "I will go visit this monk Gautama as soon as I have a chance." The queen was happy, for she was confident that once the king met the Buddha, he would understand how extraordinary the Buddha's teaching was. Chapter 42. Love is Understanding. King Pasenadi came all alone to visit the Buddha, unaccompanied by even a guard. He left his carriage and driver at the monastery gate. He was greeted by the Buddha in front of the Buddha's thatched hut. After exchanging formal greetings, the king spoke to the Buddha most frankly. "Teacher Gautama, people praise you as the Buddha, one who has attained perfect enlightenment. But I have been asking myself, how could one as young as yourself have attained enlightenment? Even the great masters such as Purana Kassapa, Makali Gosala, Nigantha Nataputta, and Sanjaya Belatiputta, who are all advanced in years, do not claim to have attained total enlightenment. Not even Pakuda Kakayana and Ajita Kesakambali. Do you know of these masters?" The Buddha responded, "Your Majesty, I have heard of all those masters and have met a number of them. Spiritual realization does not depend on age. Months and years do not guarantee the presence of enlightenment. There are some things that should never be disdained: a young prince, a small snake, a spark of fire, and a young monk. A prince may be young, but he possesses the characteristics and destiny of a king. A small poisonous snake can kill a grown man in an instant. One spark of fire can cause an entire forest or a large city to burn to ash. And a young monk can attain total enlightenment. Your Majesty, a wise person never disdains a young prince, a small snake, a spark of fire, or a young monk." King Pasenadi looked at the Buddha. He was impressed. The Buddha had spoken in a calm and quiet voice, and what he had said was at once simple and profound. The king felt he could trust the Buddha. He then asked the question that was burning within him. "Teacher Gautama, there are people who say you advise people not to love. They say you have said that the more a person loves, the more he will suffer and despair. I can see some truth in that statement, but I am unable to find peace with it. Without love, life would seem empty of meaning. Please help me resolve this." The Buddha looked at the king warmly. "Your Majesty, your question is a very good one, and many people can benefit from it. There are many kinds of love. We should examine closely the nature of each kind of love. Life has a great need of the presence of love, but not the sort of love that is based on lust, passion, attachment, discrimination, and prejudice. Majesty, there is another kind of love, sorely needed, which consists of loving kindness and compassion, or Maitri and Karuna. Usually when people speak of love, they are referring only to the love that exists between parents and children, husbands and wives, family members, or the members of one's caste or country. Because the nature of such love depends on the concepts of me and mine, it remains entangled in attachment and discrimination. People want only to love their parents, spouse, children, grandchildren, their own relatives and countrymen. Because they are caught in attachment, they worry about accidents that could befall their loved ones even before such things actually take place. When such accidents do occur, they suffer terribly. Love that is based on discrimination breeds prejudice. People become indifferent or even hostile to those outside their own circle of love. Attachment and discrimination are sources of suffering for ourselves and others. Majesty, the love for which all beings truly hunger is loving kindness and compassion. Maitri is the love that has the capacity to bring happiness to another. Karuna is the love that has the capacity to remove another's suffering. Maitri and Karuna do not demand anything in return. Loving kindness and compassion are not limited to one's parents, spouse, children, relatives, caste members, and countrymen. They extend to all people and all beings. In Maitri and Karuna, there is no discrimination, no mine or not mine. And because there is no discrimination, there is no attachment. Maitri and Karuna bring happiness and ease suffering. They do not cause suffering and despair. Without them, life would be empty of meaning, as you said. With loving kindness and compassion, life is filled with peace, joy, and contentment. Majesty, you are the ruler of an entire country. All your people would benefit by your practice of loving kindness and compassion. The king bent his head in thought. He looked up and asked the Buddha, I have a family to care for and a country to rule. If I don't love my own family and people, how can I care for them? Please help clarify this for me. Naturally, you should love your own family and people. But your love can also extend beyond your own family and people. You love and care for the prince and princess, but that doesn't prevent you from loving and caring for the other young people in the kingdom. If you can love all the young people, your now limited love will become an all-embracing love, and all the young people of the kingdom will be as your children. That is what is meant by having a heart of compassion. It is not just some ideal. It is something that can actually be realized, especially by someone like you who has so many means at his disposal. But what about the young people of other kingdoms? Nothing prevents you from loving the young people of other kingdoms as your sons and daughters, even though they do not dwell under your rule. Just because one loves one's own people is no reason not to love the peoples of other kingdoms. But how can I show my love for them when they are not under my jurisdiction? The Buddha looked at the king. The prosperity and security of one nation should not depend on the poverty and insecurity of other nations. Majesty, lasting peace and prosperity are only possible when nations join together in a common commitment to seek the welfare of all. If you truly want Kosala to enjoy peace and to prevent the young men of your kingdom from losing their lives on the battlefield, you must help other kingdoms find peace. Foreign and economic policies must follow the way of compassion for true peace to be possible. At the same time as you love and care for your own kingdom, you can love and care for other kingdoms such as Mogadha, Kasi, Videha, Sakya, and Koliya. Majesty, last year I visited my family in the kingdom of Sakya. I rested several days in Aranakutika at the foot of the Himalayas. There I spent much time reflecting on a politics based on nonviolence. I saw that nations can indeed enjoy peace and security without having to resort to violent measures such as imprisonment and execution. I spoke of these things with my father, King Suddhodana. Now I take this opportunity to share these same ideas with you. A ruler who nourishes his compassion does not need to depend on violent means. The king exclaimed, Wondrous, truly wondrous! Your words are inspiring. You truly are the Enlightened One. I promise to reflect on all you have said today. I will penetrate your words, which contain so much wisdom. But for now, please, allow me to ask one more simple question. Ordinarily, love does contain elements of discrimination, desire, and attachment. According to you, that kind of love creates worry, suffering, and despair. How can one love without desire and attachment? How can I avoid creating worry and suffering in the love I hold for my own children? The Buddha replied, We need to look at the nature of our love. Our love should bring peace and happiness to the ones we love. If our love is based on a selfish desire to possess others, we will not be able to bring them peace and happiness. On the contrary, our love will make them feel trapped. Such a love is no more than a prison. If the persons we love are unable to be happy because of our love, they will find a way to free themselves. They will not accept the prison of our love. Gradually, the love between us will turn to anger and hatred. Majesty, did you hear of the tragedy that took place 10 days ago in Savatthi because of selfish love? A mother felt she had been abandoned by her son when he fell in love and married. Rather than feeling as if she had gained a daughter, she only felt that she had lost her son, and she felt betrayed by him. Because of that, her love turned to hatred, and she put poison in the young couple's food, killing them both. Majesty, according to the way of enlightenment, love cannot exist without understanding. Love is understanding. If you cannot understand, you cannot love. Husbands and wives who do not understand each other cannot love each other. Brothers and sisters who do not understand each other cannot love each other. Parents and children who do not understand each other cannot love each other. If you want your loved ones to be happy, you must learn to understand their sufferings and their aspirations. When you understand, you will know how to relieve their sufferings and how to help them fulfill their aspirations. That is true love. If you only want your loved ones to follow your own ideas and you remain ignorant of their needs, it is not truly love. It is only a desire to possess another and attempt to fulfill your own needs, which cannot be fulfilled in that way. Majesty, the people of Kosala have sufferings and aspirations. If you can understand their sufferings and aspirations, you will be able to truly love them. All the officials in your court have sufferings and aspirations. Understand those sufferings and aspirations, and you will know how to bring them happiness. Thanks to that, they will remain loyal to you all their lives. The queen, prince, and princess have their own sufferings and aspirations. If you can understand those sufferings and aspirations, you will be able to bring them happiness. When every person enjoys happiness, peace, and joy, you yourself will know happiness, peace, and joy. That is the meaning of love according to the way of awakening. King Pasenadi was deeply moved. No other spiritual teacher or Brahmana priest had ever opened the door to his heart and allowed him to understand things so deeply. The presence of this teacher, he thought to himself, was of great value to his country. He wanted to be the Buddha's student. After a moment of silence, he looked up at the Buddha and said, I thank you for shedding so much light on these matters for me. But there remains one thing that still bothers me. You said that love based on desire and attachment creates suffering and despair, while love based on compassion brings only peace and happiness. But while I see that love based on the way of compassion is not selfish or self-serving, it still can bring pain and suffering. I love my people. When they suffer from some natural disaster like a typhoon or flood, I suffer too. I'm sure it is the same for you. Surely you suffer when you see someone who is sick or dying. Your question is very good. Thanks to this question, you will be able to understand more deeply the nature of compassion. First of all, you should know that the suffering caused by love based on desire and attachment is 1,000 times greater than the suffering that results from compassion. It is necessary to distinguish between the two kinds of suffering, one that is entirely useless and serves only to disturb our minds and bodies, and the other that nourishes caring and responsibility. Love based on compassion can provide the energy needed to respond to the suffering of others. Love based on attachment and desire only creates anxiety and more suffering. Compassion provides fuel for the most helpful actions and service. Great King, compassion is most necessary. Pain that results from compassion can be a helpful pain. If you cannot feel another person's pain, you are not truly human. Compassion is the fruit of understanding. Practicing the way of awareness is to realize the true face of life. That true face is impermanence. Everything is impermanent and without a separate self. Everything must one day pass away. One day your own body will pass away. When a person sees into the impermanent nature of all things, his way of looking becomes calm and serene. The presence of impermanence does not disturb his heart and mind, and thus the feelings of pain that result from compassion do not carry the bitter and heavy nature that other kinds of suffering do. On the contrary, compassion gives a person greater strength. Great King, today you have heard some of the basic tenets of the way of liberation. On another day, I would like to share more of the teachings with you. King Pasenadi's heart was filled with gratitude. He stood up and bowed to the Buddha. He knew that one day soon he would ask to be accepted as a lay disciple of the Buddha. He knew that Queen Malika, Prince Jetta, and Princess Vajiri already felt a special bond with the Buddha. He wanted the entire family to receive the refuges together. He knew that his younger sister, Kosala Devi, and her husband, King Bimbisara, had already received them. That evening, Queen Malika and Princess Vajiri noticed a marked difference in the king. He seemed unusually calm and content. They knew it was the result of his encounter with the Buddha. They wanted very much to ask the king about his meeting with the Buddha, but they knew that they should wait and let the king tell them about it in his own time. Chapter 43. Everyone's Tears Are Salty. King Pasenadi's visit to Jetavana stirred interest among the people and added to the stature of the Buddha's Sangha. Palace officials noticed how King Pasenadi did not miss a single weekly Dharma talk, and many of them began to join him. Some did so out of admiration for the Buddha's teaching, while others went only in hopes of pleasing the king. The number of intellectuals and young people visiting Jetavana also mounted daily. During the 3 months of retreat, more than 150 young men were ordained by Sariputta. Religious leaders of other sects that had long enjoyed the king's patronage began to feel threatened, and some of them began to regard Jetavana Monastery with less than sympathetic eyes. The retreat season concluded with a large service at which the king offered new robes to every bhikkhu and distributed food and other basic necessities to poor families. At this ceremony, the king and his family formally took the three refuges. After the retreat, the Buddha and other bhikkhus traveled to neighboring regions in order to spread the Dharma to more and more people. One day, as the Buddha and bhikkhus were begging in a village near the banks of the Ganga, the Buddha spotted a man carrying night soil. The man was an untouchable named Sunita. Sunita had heard about the Buddha and bhikkhus, but this was the first time he had ever seen them. He was alarmed, knowing how dirty his clothes were and how foul he smelled from carrying night soil. He quickly moved off the path and made his way down to the river. But the Buddha was determined to share the way with Sunita. When Sunita veered from the path, the Buddha did the same. Understanding the Buddha's intent, Sariputta and Meghiya, the Buddha's attendant at the time, followed him. The rows of other bhikkhus came to a halt, and they quietly watched. Sunita was panic-stricken. He hastily put the buckets of night soil down and looked for a place to hide. Above him stood the bhikkhus in their saffron robes, while before him approached the Buddha and two other bhikkhus. Not knowing what else to do, Sunita waded up to his knees in water and stood with his palms joined. Curious villagers came out of their homes and lined the shore to watch what was happening. Sunita had veered off the path because he was afraid he would pollute the bhikkhus. He could not have guessed the Buddha would follow him. Sunita knew that the Sangha included many men from noble castes. He was sure that polluting a bhikkhu was an unforgivable act. He hoped the Buddha and bhikkhus would leave him and return to the road. But the Buddha did not leave. He walked right up to the water's edge and said, "My friend, please come closer so we may talk." Sunita, his palms still joined, protested, "Lord, I don't dare." "Why not?" asked the Buddha. "I am an untouchable. I don't want to pollute you and your monks." The Buddha replied, "On our path, we no longer distinguish between castes. You are a human being like the rest of us. We are not afraid we will be polluted. Only greed, hatred, and delusion can pollute us. A person as pleasant as yourself brings us nothing but happiness. What is your name?"
"Lord, my name is Sunita."
"Sunita, would you like to become a bhikkhu like the rest of us?"
"I couldn't."
"Why not?"
"I'm an untouchable."
"Sunita,
I have already explained that on our path there is no caste. In the way of awakening, caste no longer exists. It is like the Ganga, Yamuna, Achiravati, Sarabhu, Mahi, and Rohini rivers. Once they empty into the sea, they no longer retain their separate identities. A person who leaves home to follow the way leaves caste behind, whether he was born a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, or untouchable. Sunita, if you like, you can become a bhikkhu like the rest of us. Sunita could hardly believe his ears. He placed his joined palms before his forehead and said, "No one has ever spoken so kindly to me before. This is the happiest day of my life. If you accept me as your disciple, I vow to devote all my being to practicing your teaching." The Buddha handed his bowl to Meghiya and reached his hand out to Sunita. He said, "Sariputta, help me bathe Sunita. We will ordain him a bhikkhu right here on the bank of the river." Venerable Sariputta smiled. He placed his own bowl on the ground and came forward to assist the Buddha. Sunita felt awkward and uncomfortable as Sariputta and the Buddha scrubbed him clean, but he didn't dare protest. The Buddha asked Meghiya to go up and ask Ananda for an extra robe. After Sunita was ordained, the Buddha assigned him to Sariputta's care. Sariputta led him back to Jetavana, while the Buddha and the rest of the bhikkhus calmly continued their begging. The local people had witnessed all this take place. News quickly spread that the Buddha had accepted an untouchable into his sangha. This caused a furor among higher castes in the capital. Never in the history of Kosala had an untouchable been accepted into a spiritual community. Many condemned the Buddha for violating sacred tradition. Others went so far as to suggest that the Buddha was plotting to overthrow the existing order and wreak havoc in the country. The echoes of all these accusations reached the monastery through lay disciples as well as from bhikkhus who heard people saying such things in the city. Senior disciples Sariputta, Mahakasapa, Mahamoggallana, and Anuruddha met to discuss the people's reactions with the Buddha. The Buddha said, "Accepting untouchables into the Sangha was simply a question of time. Our way is a way of equality. We do not recognize caste. Though we may encounter difficulties over Sunita's ordination now, we will have opened a door for the first time in history that future generations will thank us for. We must have courage." Moggallana said, "We do not lack courage or endurance, but how can we help reduce the hostility of public opinion to make it easier for the bhikkhus to practice?" Sariputta said, "The important thing is to remain trusting of our practice. I will strive to assist Sunita in making progress on the path. His success will be the strongest argument in our favor. We can also seek ways to explain our belief in equality to the people. What do you think, Master?" The Buddha placed his hand on Sariputta's shoulder. "You have just spoken my own thoughts," he said. Before long, the uproar over Sunita's ordination reached the ears of King Pasenadi. A group of religious leaders requested a private audience with him and expressed their grave concerns over the matter. Their convincing arguments disturbed the king, and although he was a devoted follower of the Buddha, he promised the leaders that he would look into the matter. Some days later, he paid a visit to Jetavana. He climbed down from his carriage and walked into the monastery grounds alone. Bhikkhus passed him on the path beneath the cool shade of trees. The king followed the path that led to the Buddha's hut. He bowed to each bhikkhu he passed. As always, the serene and composed manner of the bhikkhus reinforced his faith in the Buddha. Halfway to the hut, he encountered a bhikkhu sitting on a large rock beneath a great pine tree teaching a small group of bhikkhus and lay disciples. It was a most appealing sight. The bhikkhu offering the teaching looked less than 40 years old, yet his face radiated great peace and wisdom. His listeners were clearly absorbed by what he had to say. The king paused to listen and was moved by what he heard. But suddenly he remembered the purpose of his visit, and he continued on his way. He hoped to return later to listen to the bhikkhu's teaching. The Buddha welcomed the king outside his hut, inviting him to sit on a bamboo chair. After they exchanged formal greetings, the king asked the Buddha who the bhikkhu sitting on the rock was. The Buddha smiled and answered, "That is Bhikkhu Sunita. He was once an untouchable who carried night soil. What do you think of his teaching?" The king felt embarrassed. The bhikkhu with so radiant a bearing was none other than the night soil carrier Sunita. He would never have guessed this was possible. Before he knew how to respond, the Buddha said, "Bhikkhu Sunita has devoted himself wholeheartedly to his practice from the day of his ordination. He is a man of great sincerity, intelligence, and resolve. Though he was ordained only 3 months ago, he has already earned a reputation for great virtue and purity of heart. Would you like to meet him and make an offering to this most worthy bhikkhu?" The king replied with frankness, "I would indeed like to meet Bhikkhu Sunita and make an offering to him. Master, your teaching is deep and wondrous. I have never met any other spiritual teacher with so open a heart and mind. I do not think there is a person, animal, or plant that does not benefit from the presence of your understanding. I must tell you that I came here today with the intention of asking how you could accept an untouchable into your Sangha. But I have seen, heard, and understood why. I no longer dare ask such a question. Instead, allow me to prostrate myself before you." The king stood up, intending to prostrate himself, but the Buddha stood up as well and took the king's hand. He asked the king to be seated again. When they were both seated, the Buddha looked at the king and said, "Majesty, in the way of liberation, there is no caste. To the eyes of an enlightened person, all people are equal. Every person's blood is red. Every person's tears are salty. We are all human beings. We must find a way for all people to be able to realize their full dignity and potential. That is why I welcomed Sunita into the Sangha of Bhikkhus." The king joined his palms. "I understand now. I also know that the path you have chosen will be filled with obstacles and difficulties. But I know you possess the strength and courage needed to overcome all such obstacles. For my own part, I will do everything in my power to support the true teaching." The king took his leave of the Buddha and returned to the pine tree in hopes of listening to Bhikkhu Sunita's teaching. But Bhikkhu Sunita and his listeners had disappeared. The king saw no more than a few bhikkhus walking slowly and mindfully down the path. Chapter 44. The Elements Will Recombine. One day, Meghia spoke to the Buddha about Nanda's unhappiness as a monk. Nanda had confided to Meghia how much he missed his fiancée in Kapilavatu. Nanda said, "I still remember the day I carried the Buddha's bowl back to Nigrodha Park. As I was leaving, Janapada Kalyani looked into my eyes and said, 'Hurry back, I will be waiting for you.' I can so clearly recall the sheen of her black hair as it brushes her slender shoulders. Her image often arises during my sitting meditation. Every time I see her in my mind, I am filled with longing. I am not happy being a monk." The next afternoon, the Buddha invited Nanda to go for a walk with him. They left Jetavana and headed toward a distant hamlet located by a lake. They sat on a large boulder that overlooked the crystal-clear water. A family of ducks swam by leisurely. Birds sang in the overhanging branches of trees. The Buddha said, "Some of our brothers have told me that you are not happy living the life of a bhikkhu. Is that true?" Nanda was silent. After a moment, the Buddha asked, "Do you feel ready to return to Kapilavatu to prepare to take over the throne?" Nanda replied hastily, "No, no, I have already told everyone that I do not like politics. I know I don't have the ability to rule a kingdom. I do not wish to become the next king." "Then why are you unhappy being a bhikkhu?" Again, Nanda was silent. "Do you miss Kalyani?" Nanda blushed, but he did not speak. The Buddha said, "Nanda, there are many young women here in Kosala as beautiful as your Kalyani. Do you remember the reception we attended at King Pasenadi's palace? Did you notice any women there as pretty as Kalyani?" Nanda admitted, "Perhaps there are young women here as pretty as she is, but I care only for Kalyani. In this life, there is only one Kalyani." "Nanda, attachment can be a great barrier to spiritual practice. The physical beauty of a woman fades as surely as the beauty of a rose. You know that all things are impermanent. You must learn to penetrate the impermanent nature of things. Look." The Buddha pointed to an old woman leaning on a cane and hobbling across the bamboo bridge. Her face was covered with wrinkles. "That old woman was surely once a beauty. Kalyani's beauty will also fade with the years. During that same time, Your search for enlightenment could bring peace and joy for this life and lives to come. Nanda, look at the two monkeys playing over on that branch. You might not find the female attractive with her long, pointed snout and red bottom, but to the male she is the most beautiful monkey on earth. To him she is unique, and he would sacrifice his very life to protect her. Can you see that? Nanda interrupted the Buddha. Please don't say anything more. I understand what you're trying to say. I will devote myself more wholeheartedly to my practice. The Buddha smiled at his younger brother. Pay special attention to observing your breath. Meditate on your body, feelings, mental formations, consciousness, and objects of your consciousness. Look deeply in order to see the process of birth, growth, and fading of every phenomenon, from your own body, emotions, mind, and objects of your mind. If there is anything you don't understand, come and ask me or Sariputta. Nanda, remember that the happiness liberation brings is true, unconditional happiness. It can never be destroyed. Aspire to that happiness. The sky was growing dark. The Buddha and Nanda stood and walked back to the monastery. Jetavana now hosted a strong and stable monastic life. The number of bhikkhus living there had risen to 500. The following year, the Buddha returned to Vesali for the retreat season. The Lekavi princes had transformed Great Forest into a monastery. They had built a two-story dharma hall with a roof, which they named Kuttagara. A number of smaller buildings were scattered throughout the forest of sal trees. The princes were the sponsors of the retreat season with generous contributions from Ambapali. Bhikkhus throughout Magadha and as far away as Sakya gathered to spend the retreat season there with the Buddha. They numbered 600 in all. Lay disciples traveled to spend the rainy season there as well in order to receive the Buddha's teaching. They brought daily food offerings and attended all the Dharma talks. One morning in early autumn, just after the retreat came to a close, the Buddha received news that King Suddhodana was on his deathbed in Kapilavatu. The king had sent Prince Mahanama, his nephew, as a messenger to summon the Buddha in hopes of seeing his son one last time. At Mahanama's special request, the Buddha agreed to travel in the carriage in order to save time. Anuruddha, Nanda, Ananda, and Rahula accompanied him. They left so quickly that even the Lekavi princes and Ambapali were unable to see them off. After the carriage departed, 200 bhikkhus, including all the former princes of the Sakya clan, began to walk toward Kapilavatu. They wanted to be with the Buddha at his father's funeral. The royal family met the Buddha at the palace gates. Mahapajapati led him at once into the king's chambers. The king's face, pale and wan, brightened when he saw the Buddha. The Buddha sat down by the bed and took the king's hand in his own. The king, now 82 years old, was thin and frail. The Buddha said, "Father, please breathe gently and slowly. Smile. Nothing is more important than your breath at this moment. Nanda, Ananda, Rahula, Anuruddha, and I will breathe together with you." The king looked at each one of them. He smiled and began to follow his breath. No one dared cry. After a moment, the king looked at the Buddha and said, "I have seen clearly the impermanence of life, and how if a person wants happiness, he should not lose himself in a life of desires. Happiness is obtained by living a life of simplicity and freedom." Queen Gotami told the Buddha, "These past months the king has lived very simply. He has followed your teaching. Your teaching has transformed the lives of every one of us here." Still holding the king's hand, the Buddha said, "Father, take a deep look at me, at Nanda and Rahula. Look at the green leaves on the branches outside your window. Life continues. As life continues, so do you. You will continue to live in me and in Nanda and Rahula and in all beings. The temporal body arises from the four elements, which dissolve only to endlessly recombine again. Father, don't think that because the body passes away, life and death can bind us. Rahula's body is also your body." The Buddha motioned to Rahula to come and hold the king's other hand. A lovely smile arose on the face of the dying king. He understood the Buddha's words, and he no longer feared death. The king's advisors and ministers were all present. He motioned for them to approach, and in a feeble voice said, During my reign, I have doubtlessly upset and wronged you. Before I die, I ask your forgiveness." The advisors and ministers could not hold back their tears. Prince Mahanama knelt by the bed and said, "Your Majesty, you have been the most virtuous and just of kings. No one here has any reason to fault you." Mahanama continued, "I humbly wish to suggest that Prince Nanda now leave monastic life and return to Kapilavatu to ascend the throne. The people would all be happy to see your own son as king. I pledge to assist and support him with all my being." Nanda looked at the Buddha as if to plead for rescue. Queen Gotami also looked at the Buddha's way. Quietly, the Buddha spoke, "Father, ministers, please allow me to share my insight in this matter. Nanda does not yet possess the inclination or ability to serve as a political ruler. He needs more years of spiritual practice to be ready for such a task. Rahula is only 15 years old and too young to become king. I believe Prince Mahanama is the best qualified to be king. He is a man of great intelligence and talent, as well as a man of compassion and understanding. Furthermore, he has served as the king's chief advisor these past 6 years. On behalf of the royal family, on behalf of the people, I ask Prince Mahanama to accept this difficult responsibility." Mahanama joined his palms and protested, "I fear my talent falls far short of what is required of a king. Please, Your Majesty, Lord Buddha, and ministers, choose someone more worthy than I am." The other ministers voiced their approval of the Buddha's suggestion. The king nodded his approval as well and called Mahanama to his side. He took Mahanama's hand and said, "Everyone places his trust in you. The Buddha himself has faith in you. You are my nephew, and I would be honored and happy to pass the throne unto you. You will continue our line for 100 generations. Mahanama bowed, submitting to the king's wishes. The king was overjoyed. "Now I can close my eyes in peace. I am happy to have seen the Buddha before I left this world. My heart is now without any cares whatsoever. I have no regrets or bitterness. I hope that the Buddha will rest in Kapilavatu for a time in order to assist Mahanama in the first days of his reign. Your virtue, Lord Buddha, will assure our country 100 generations of peace." The king's voice faded to barely a whisper. The Buddha said, "I will remain here for whatever time is needed to help Mahanama." The king smiled weakly, but his eyes radiated peace. He closed his eyes and passed from this life. Queen Gotami and Yosadhara began to cry. The ministers sobbed in grief. The Buddha folded the king's hands on his chest and then motioned for everyone to stop crying. He told them to follow their breathing. After several moments, he suggested they meet in the outer chamber to discuss arrangements for the funeral. The funeral took place 7 days later. More than 1,000 Brahmins attended the ceremony. But King Suddhodana's funeral was made unique by the presence of 500 saffron-robed bhikkhus who represented the way of the Buddha. In addition to the traditional Brahmana prayers and recitations, sutras of the way were chanted. The bhikkhus chanted the Four Noble Truths, the Sutra on Impermanence, the Sutra on Fire, the Sutra on Dependent Co-arising, and the Three Refuges. They chanted in the tongue of Magadhi, which was spoken by all the peoples east of the Ganga. The Buddha slowly circled the funeral pyre 3 times. Before he lit the funeral pyre, he said, "Birth, old age, sickness, and death occur in the life of all persons. We should reflect on birth, old age, sickness, and death every day in order to prevent ourselves from becoming lost in desires and in order to be able to create a life filled with peace, joy, and contentment. A person who has attained the way looks on birth, old age, sickness, and death with equanimity. The true nature of all dharmas is that there is neither birth nor death, neither production nor destruction, neither increasing nor decreasing." Once lit, flames consumed the pyre. The sounds of gongs and drums intertwined with chanting. The people of Kapilavatu attended in great numbers to see the Buddha light the king's funeral pyre. After Mahanama's coronation, the Buddha remained in Kapilavatu for 3 months. One day, Mahapajapati Gotami visited him at Nigrodha Park. She offered a number of robes and also requested to be ordained as a nun. She said, If you will allow women to be ordained, many will benefit. Among our clan, many princes have left home to become your disciples. Many of them had wives. Now their wives desire to study the Dharma as nuns. I want to be ordained myself. It would bring me great joy. This has been my sole desire since the king died." The Buddha was silent for a long moment before he said, "It is not possible." Lady Pajapati pleaded, "I know this is a difficult issue for you. If you accept women into the Sangha, you will be met with protest and resistance from society. But I do not believe you are afraid of such reactions." Again the Buddha was silent. He said, "In Rajagaha there are also a number of women who want to be ordained, but I don't believe it is the right time yet. Conditions are not yet ripe to accept women in the Sangha." Gotami pleaded 3 times with him, but his answer remained the same. Deeply disappointed, she departed. When she returned to the palace, she told Yasodhara of the Buddha's response. A few days later, the Buddha returned to Vesali. After his departure, Gotami gathered all the women who wished to be ordained. They included a number of young women who had never been married. All the women belonged to the Sakya clan. She told them, "I know beyond a doubt that in the way of awakening, all people are equal. Everyone has the capacity to be enlightened and liberated. The Buddha has said so himself. He has accepted untouchables into the Sangha. There is no reason he should not accept women. We are full persons too. We can attain enlightenment and liberation. There is no reason to regard women as inferior. I suggest we shave our heads, get rid of our fine clothes and jewels, put on the yellow robes of bhikkhus, and walk barefoot to Vesali, where we will ask to be ordained. In this way, we will prove to the Buddha and everyone else that we are capable of living simply and practicing the way. We will walk hundreds of miles and beg for our food. This is the only hope we have to be accepted into the Sangha." All the women agreed with Gotami. They saw in her a true leader. Yasodhara smiled. She had long appreciated Gotami's strong will. Gotami was not one to be stopped by any obstacle, as proved by her years of working on behalf of the poor with Yasodhara. The women agreed on a day to put their plan into action. Gotami said to Yasodhara, "Gopa, it would be best if you didn't come with us this time. Things may go more smoothly. When we have succeeded, there will be plenty of time for you to follow." Yasodhara smiled in understanding.